Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Garden Better, the podcast from Better Homes and Gardens magazine. I'm Adam Woodhams.
And I'm Jenny Dillon.
We're both horticulturalists, and in each episode we'll be dishing the dirt on all things gardening, guiding you through the season and taking a look at what's hot and what's not, and how you can keep things thriving in your own little patch of paradise. In this episode, we're going to give you all you need to know about pruning roses, and we've got loads of fantastic tips on caring for your citrus and harvesting your fruit. Plus, we've got a fantastic interview with Marone Mayett from Tree Movals all about how they move those big trees in and out of landscapes.
And don't forget, Milton Black will be here to give us his tips for gardening by the moon.
You're listening to Garden Better from Better Homes and Gardens magazine. Across spring and summer and even into autumn, that beautiful, beautiful look and fragrance of roses in the garden, they are just amazing, are they not, Jen?
They make you stop in your tracks.
And now, this time of year, not so much.
No.
Really. That's kind of all that foliage is gone.
Well, and yeah, they're just about finished.
Yeah, any foliage that's there might be looking pretty yellow and horrible, and you've basically most likely got lots of really ugly thorny sticks in the garden. But that is actually just how we want them at this time of year, isn't it, Jen? We want them to be all naked and free like that.
That's one way to put it, Adam.
Well, I was actually thinking about the fact that it is rose pruning time. This is the time of year. Then you do some work now on your roses, and that is what gives you those beautiful blooms come spring and summer. Because how many times have you seen it, you know, the old guy down the road with these incredible rose bushes just totally and utterly covered in blooms? The secret is in the pruning. It really is.
Yeah. That's why you prune. It's why you cut it back. But there's lots of other reasons too. I mean, it's really important, I think. I mean, why do you prune? Well, you get rid of all the dead and diseased and dying canes. Also, you want to improve the appearance of the bush. You've got some canes growing in all odd directions, cutting across each other. Air circulation is really important, especially if you're in a humid area. You've got to keep the center of the rose bush really, really clear for that air to go through. And then there's the other little thing is that happens with grafted roses is that you get suckers at the base. Just get rid of those.
Yes, indeed. That's the most common thing when you talk to people at garden shows and things, and they say, I've got a problem with my rose. It hasn't flowered for years. And the first question often is the growth coming from below the clear graft? And you can normally see that graft because you'll have a straight trunk coming up, and then you'll have a stem out the side, and that stem out the side is actually the grafted bit. And if it's coming from below that, then it's going to be a section of rose that really is not going to flower particularly well because it's what they call the understock. So you need to be cutting that off, making sure that's gone. And that can often be very vigorous too, can't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's the old-fashioned gardeners used to call it the water shoots. You know, they just rocket right up at high speed. But that's the thing with roses. They're such vigorous growers in the warm seasons that you end up with, you know, this neatly pruned framework. When you look at it again the next winter season and it's all bare, you think, that couldn't be the same rose. There's just so much rampant growth has happened across one season.
I know. And it's the time for tough love. You really got to cut it back.
Yeah, well, and the important thing to remember too is that roses flower best on new wood. So you don't want it filled up with all old wood and all that really solid stuff in the center, which it does, by the nature of rose bushes, can often get quite diseased and things too. So you need to get in there and trim out that old wood. As you said, open up the center. That's really important, creating the framework of the plant. And the big problem that people always talk about with roses is fungal problems. And that's, as you said, air circulation. So you keep that framework nice and open. You can get good air movement through the bush, and that reduces the humidity and therefore the likelihood of fungal disorders.
So we're going to prune our rose bushes. What do we need?
Well, the first thing you need is a very good quality, sharp pair of secateurs. And sharp is the key word there, because you need to have really nice quality cuts on every single cut that you're making. It needs to be good, not crushing the stem at all.
And how do you make that cut?
You need to make the cut. The important thing is to remember you can prune a lot off rose bushes, but I always stick to the philosophy of that take a little bit off, step back, have a look at it, because you can take more off, but you can't put it back on.
You can't.
Simple as that.
Ask any carpenter about cutting.
That's exactly right. So you can make your cuts a few times and until you feel you've got the shape right. But the important thing is that you want to make your pruning cut to just above an outward-facing bud. Now, these will be obvious even in winter. They're the little buds that are sitting dormant waiting for spring. Mm-hmm. And you want a bud that's on the outside of the stem. Now, make the cut about a centimetre above that bud and slope it back to the inside of the bush. So the highest point of the cut is on the outside of the bush and the lowest point's on the inside.
And it's really important that you do cut it at an angle, isn't it?
It certainly is. I mean, there's a couple of things happen there. That makes sure that the bud has still got a lot of security within the wood, but it's also making sure moisture doesn't build up on top of the cut, which then leads to fungal problems down through the stem and the core of the plant.
And talking about fungal problems, I mean, if you've got a whole line of rose bushes, you've got to make sure that you clean your secateurs every time you move from one bush to the next.
Yeah, that's a really important thing. Roses are known for getting viruses and also obviously transfer of fungal problems. So if you've got a few roses to prune, I recommend either having just like a little cup of methylated spirits, because metho is fantastic as a sterilizing agent, or have it just in a little puffer pack. And between bushes, you need to give your secateurs a dip into that metho or spray them with the puffer pack and then wipe them down with a clean rag before you move on to pruning the next plant.
Don't forget the gloves.
Don't forget the – oh, yes. Try and find long ones too. They call them long gauntlet gloves, and they go about halfway up your forearms. Really need those because you just get so many prickles from rose bushes. And you know one I like to do as well, because I've fallen for this mistake myself, is you prune a couple of rose bushes and you're just throwing everything over your shoulder and you end up with a big pile you've got to multiply handle. Keep a big garbage bin or something with you and put all the cuttings straight into the bin so that you're not actually having to double or triple handle all of this stuff. And then I always recommend after you've pruned, even though it's winter and they're dormant, give them a good feed with a quality rose food and then my favourite, loosened mulch. Loosened mulch is absolutely brilliant for roses. And then come spring, they are going to go crazy.
Gangbusters.
Now, without doubt, Jen, I reckon the most popular fruit trees would have to be citrus. You know, we've got varieties for just about everywhere around the country. What do you reckon?
Well, you just haven't grown up in Australia without a lemon tree in the back garden.
No, it's very true, isn't it? I can't think of people that did not have a lemon tree in the back garden. Hey, bit of absolute trivia for you as well. I've made many a visit out to Norfolk Island, and there's very, very old lemon trees growing out there, and they're the classic thorny, wrinkly old lemon that is thought that they were actually, in fact, on the island before the first fleeters arrived there. And it
How'd
was thought that
there?
Some Polynesians put them there when they were travelling down to places like New Zealand, which is fascinating in itself. But there was an enormous lemon industry out on Norfolk Island, and one of the things they used to do was use the seeds to create the understock for growing roots back on the mainland. So they would send the seeds and little shot plants back to the mainland, and that would be used for grafting for citrus on the Australian market. So there actually is a chance, you know, that thorny old lemon that people had in the backyard, there is a chance that you actually have a very old variety of lemon tree that originated from Norfolk Island in your backyard.
Bit of history. Are they as rebellious as the bounty guys?
Pretty much. And you don't want to back into one either, a bounty guy or one of those thorny old lemons.
Yep, absolutely.
Now, a mature lemon tree, a lot of people don't realise this. They think a few fruit, a handful of fruit.
No.
There are records of mature lemon trees producing literally thousands of fruit off one tree.
And it just, what can you do with so many lemons?
That's a lot of lemon jam and lemon butter and lemonade, isn't it?
That's what you see often in offices. You know, people come in with bags, sacks of lemons, just having to give them away.
Because they do have that tendency of popping up all at once, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if you plant a grafted tree, if you're going to put a citrus in, most of the citrus that you buy will be grafted. And that means, as I mentioned before, basically the plant you want is grafted onto the top of a different sort of understock because that understock is stronger and more vigorous and that sort of thing. When you put them in, most of them will want a fruit the first year round, but I've found from experience, and some growers have backed this up as well, it's a good idea to remove that first year's fruit. Don't let the tree fruit the first year it's in the ground.
No, because it's taking up too much energy. It needs to really develop its strength over the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's right. You want it building up its root system, and you want it building strong branches, because yes. You know, often those new plants, they've only got very thin branches, and if you suddenly have three full-size lemons hanging off the end of it, you know what's going to happen to that branch.
Yeah, it's going to fall off.
Now, the way you can manage fruit on citrus varieties varies a lot, and it gets very confusing because there's so much hybridization now, isn't there, with the different citrus, with the, you know, lemons crossed with mandarins, crossed with limes, crossed with oranges.
You can get three in one pot.
Yeah, you do. You get those multigraphs, which are even more confusing. But the funny thing is that citrus allow you to still be picking fruit well into winter, and that's in fact a really good thing, because they're a great fruit to have around at this time of year, very rich in vitamin C, of course, and there's many thoughts that vitamin C is fantastic when you're trying to ward off coughs and colds.
Well, this is the best time of the year for fruit, because guess what's on the market? Mandarins.
Yes.
I can't get enough. You know, I could come back home with a bag full, probably 20, 24 mandarins, and they're gone in a couple of days.
And eat the whole lot. Mandarins are like that, aren't they? They are absolutely fantastic. But the interesting thing is that some of the citrus, the fruit can be what they describe as being stored on the tree. So you don't actually need to pick it. And in fact, most citrus, you do want to wait until they're completely ripe before you pick them. And mandarins are a great one. I've found that the trick with picking when a mandarin's ready to pick is to check the skin, and it will just be starting to lift away from the flesh. You just get a little bit of feeling like there's padding underneath. Mm. That's when a mandarin, when you pick it off the tree, is just going to be absolutely perfect to eat.
Well, see, my girls have been hanging out for mandarins for ages and ages, and I've said, well, okay, these ones are just still too tight. They're not fleshy enough. They're not going to be sweet enough. And just now, the fleshy open mandarins are coming out.
They're just coming right, yeah.
And they're so sweet.
Yeah, but lemons and limes are the best ones that you can pick a little bit early. But but others, like the grapefruits, you need a lot of patience, and they need to ripen on the tree. They take about 6 to 8 months for the
Otherwise
fruit to ripen.
Otherwise they're too sour.
Yeah. They're an acquired taste, aren't
they? No. If you pick them too early, they just. I know if you wait till they're mature, they are sweet. You don't need to put sugar on.
You do have a difference in the taste. Mm. Yeah. And I think that's the thing, that people have probably gotten used to the mass market supermarket type fruit, which of course they do pick early, and they pick it for convenience, so it's going to transport well and everything, and it never quite gets that taste. I mean, I know the difference myself between navel oranges when I was a kid and that were bought from the fruit and veg, as opposed to the navel oranges that you get today from a supermarket. There's a great big difference in the taste, or of course a navel orange that comes off a tree.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's a good point too. There's different characteristics with how things colour up depending on where you are in the country. So, for instance, if you're down in the southern states, you'll find that something like a navel orange goes a very distinctly orange colour when it's ripe. But if you're up my region in the subtropics, it's not unusual for the fruit to still hold a lot of green even when it's completely ripe. So it can take a little bit of local knowledge before you know when these things can be ready to pick.
Yep. Now, what about the native citrus?
Oh, I love them. Aren't they? They are a truly weird and wacky fruit that are just, I think they're fantastic.
We're talking about here the finger limes, which come from the ugliest little tree you could imagine. Tiny, tiny leaves, lots of spikes, just like most citruses. And then they produce these little fat fingers of limes, and they just look so ugly. But it's when you open them up and this fruit spills out like beads of caviar.
That's what amazes me. They're like little beads of caviar, except that each one will pop in your mouth with this incredibly intense citrus flavour.
Yes, it's an absolute sensation. And you can use them. They're not used enough, but you can use them in all sorts of food, your seafoods, your salads, turn them into marmalade. Just the most wonderful things. I think everyone should have one.
Yeah, I agree. And they do quite well in pots too, as a lot of citrus do very well in pots. Hey, one pest watch thing at this time of year, there is a bit of a bug that you can get on citrus called the citrus gall wasp, and that's where you get that horrible swelling on the stem.
Yeah. So how would you get rid of that? I would just go out and chop it off with a sharp knife.
There's nothing else you can do apart from cutting it off. You basically need to cut below the gall, so cut that whole stem off and dispose of it, wrap that up in something and dispose of it in the rubbish. Don't put it in the compost or anything. And it is actually important to do it at this time of year because those wasps will get active again
once
the weather warms up.
August is about the time that they hatch, and then you've got more of them.
So that is a bit of a bug to look for. And now winter is a good time to be moving a lot of trees, and citrus are one of those trees that are known for being reasonably transplantable. So why don't we get an expert in to talk to us about moving trees, Jen?
Okay. Who have you got?
We've got Marome Mayard from Tree Movals. The name says it all, moving, not removing. Now, it's a very specialised field, moving trees. How on earth did you get into that?
Yeah, well, we've always sort of I've always grown up in the industry, so I've always had the nursery, sort of working in the nursery and around nurseries. And my father got into transplanting back in the early 80s. Did a big job in Darling Harbour, which was the original Darling Harbour development. We moved hundreds of palms in and out of that place, and mainly in. And from there on, he's just moved on and done more and more work and different jobs all over the place. And a few years back, about 15, 16 years ago, we split the business, so we stopped doing the smaller stock and moving into just doing transplanting. And we still grow other trees as well, but mainly well, a bit of both really, transplanting and nursery grown trees. So
now I assume you don't just send a gang out with a heap of shovels and try and dig something up. Have you got specialist equipment for some of this stuff? I mean, because I've seen the size of some of the things you guys move. I mean, if following you on Instagram and looking at some of the stuff you do, the mind boggles about how you do it. So there must be some specialist gear involved.
Yeah, we've got a few different options to do. Sometimes we have to go back to just hand digging sometimes, depending on access and the type of trees. But mainly we use what we have a couple of different machines that we use a trench digger on. So the trench digger will just basically rip around the tree really fast. It's really fast and efficient, and that's what a lot of our transplanting is, has to be fast, has to be a quick turnaround from digging, lifting and putting back in the ground or potting on or whatever we're actually doing with our job. So it's a nice fast method of doing it, rips around, go and various ways of getting the tree out. Just depends on the tree, really.
And I suppose sometimes it would have to be fast because you'd be pulling trees out of things like demolition jobs before the construction starts, so they'd probably not give you an enormous amount of notice and say, hey, we've got these big date palms out the front, you want to come and rip them out? And so do you sometimes, for example, pull a tree out from a landscape for a builder or a designer and then kind of park that and then bring it back into the landscape afterwards? Does that sort of thing happen?
Yeah, there's a whole range of things that we do. So we can move trees on site and move them into their final location, or sometimes we can actually move a tree and set up either temporarily put it into site and then move it again once the site's finished, so we can set almost like an on-site nursery. It's a bit hard in Sydney because there's not a lot of room to do that sort of work, but yeah, we can do that. Or a few other options, we can actually just bring the tree back to our nursery, hold it for however many months, weeks it takes to long, how long it takes to do the development, and then we bring the trees back. So and then we can just move trees off site completely.
I know as a gardener and a horticulturalist, there's some stuff that moves really well. And I remember, in fact, the great Colin Campbell saying years ago that he'd had camellias in his yard that he'd moved so many times, all he had to do was walk past with a shovel and whistle, and they'd jump out of the ground and follow him. You know, so there's some stuff moves well. Are there some things you encounter that you've found are really tricky to move, or you'll just look at and you'll say, it can't be done?
Yeah, a lot of the native species. Obviously gum trees and things like that, eucalypts, acacias, There's a few out there that just a no go. Some of the palms now we don't do a lot more. We don't do as many of as we used to. The resale for those isn't there anymore. And also things like Phoenix canariensis we're not really touching anymore because of certain diseases and things that are in them. It's just too hard to handle them. So I think sort of that some of those varieties aren't going to be used in Sydney anymore. But there's certain varieties of natives that can't be done, but there's also some that can be done as well. So like tuckaroos and macadamias are really good treated transplants.
That's interesting. Yeah. And is there something that you find's really easy to move that's your favourite that, you know, when someone rings up and says, we've got a big go, beauty.
Japanese maples. All the Asa varieties, yeah. They're really good because they can be done all year round rather than just in winter, which a lot of people think that they can only be done in winter being a deciduous tree, but they transplant really well.
I remember many years ago working on a landscape job with a group of trainees and we had a Japanese maple that we had to move and I said, okay, this is going to be our task. We'll go through the whole process and we, you know, trenched it out, did everything and it was fantastic until we realised that we had about half a ton of root ball. About eight of us had to try and move 20 metres to the other side of the site.
That's the catch. It's that root ball when it's got natural earth soil, it's so much heavier than you actually expect it to be. And the initial lift is usually the issue, getting, you know, 2 or 3 ton of lift out, just to lift a 500 kilo tree, just to pry it out of the ground is usually the hard part of the job.
That's an enormous task, absolutely enormous task. And as I mentioned before, you know, sometimes you must park trees, but you guys must have an enormous nursery. I mean, do you have a big growing space where you keep stuff in reserve Does it tend to cycle a bit faster than that?
It doesn't cycle as quick as I'd like it to. We've got a lot of trees that we've had for many, many years. I've got a couple of trees that I remember transplanting myself when I was a young boy still at primary school. So, doing school work on holidays and things. Work on school holidays. So some of that stock can move pretty quick. We're on a site that's about 10 acres under production. So we've got 10 acres, a mixture of transplanted and nursery grown stock, but it's not that much room, but we don't tend to take a lot more. We're not taking a lot of stock at the moment.
Where do your trees end up? It's because I've often found that fascinating. When you see you mentioned Darling Harbour before, I can remember when that was being originally developed, and I found it, even though I was only vaguely connected with the industry then, I still remember finding it fascinating that you had this construction site and then almost overnight there's
– turned into a huge –
it's
development.
Got trees. Yeah. It's got landscape. Yeah. It's just absolutely amazing.
And that's the norm now. A lot of the trees that we move in, it's all the norm now to put real big stock in, which is great.
Yeah.
But all our stock goes all over Sydney, all over – and even the East Coast and Adelaide and – I haven't cracked Perth yet, but we'd like to sense that the quarantine's pretty hard over there. But all over Sydney mainly. All the high-end landscape designers buy some big stock that sort of instant effect, you know, beautiful courtyard trees and a whole range, you know.
And what's the biggest sort of thing you've ever moved?
Quite a few years ago we moved we actually got a site at Oberon as well where we do cold climate trees. And it's a bit more of a hobby. We don't do a lot of stuff in there, but we did move a 15.5-metre sequoia sempervirens.
Wow.
Which came up at about 11 tonnes. So there was a huge sleepless nights attached to that, but it was a great reward when it moved, transplanted really well, and it went all the way down to Melbourne and took off. Yeah, it looked really good. A couple of years later, it was stunning.
Yeah, that's just enormous.
Yeah.
And I believe your trees don't just get used in landscapes. You get all sorts of weird and wonderful requests for where your plant stock gets used, that it's not just things like landscapes, that it gets used for props and styling and all sorts of.
Yeah, we've been doing a little bit of that lately. We've put a lot of trees in. I think ever since the Royals had their trees in there, there was at Harry and Meghan, they put some trees into their church service, and all of a sudden everyone wants trees. There's church services and we do all that sort of thing. A couple of the movies a few years ago, we put a heap of trees in for those sort of things as well. So, yeah, a whole range of requests for our stock. So
that's brilliant, isn't it? And people think it's all just tiny little trees. Mm. And what's your most difficult install that you've ever done, or the weirdest sort of install that you've done?
We moved some – long time ago now, we moved some big phoenix palms, about 6-7 metre trees, into a site that was on the water. So we used a crane on a barge to move these trees in, and we had to play around with tides, and we only had a really short window, and it was very stressful, but the job's done. And every time I drive past, I think one of the bridges there, I can sort of pop my head still down and have a look and see it. You can't see it from the road.
Yeah, a bit so hard to put the jacks down to proper barge, isn't it?
Yeah, and every time that that another boat would come flying past, the tree would all of a sudden go up and back down again, and it was extremely hard, but we did it.
Would have been challenging. So you got a couple of quick tips if folks wanted to move a tree at home, a couple of quick tips for moving and for aftercare of a tree they moved.
Mainly the problem with transplanting is access. So if you can get access to the tree, having sort of a car space area to get up to the tree to transplant it. Other than that, make sure the soil's nice and moist, not too wet, not boggy, but wet enough for the root ball to hold together. That's about it, really. And then aftercare is just water.
Yeah, just water. Yeah.
90% of our issues that we have with moving stock and planting stock is the aftercare of watering, and that's pretty much it.
My own mate from Alpine Removals. Thanks, mate.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. See you again soon.
Gardening by the Moon with Milton Black.
Hi, Milton. How are you?
Very well, Jenny. Thank you very much. And what a wonderful time to be in the garden. In the middle of winter. Absolutely great. But the thing is that you've got to watch in the garden, you know, don't forget this is the month where you've got to spray those roses and look after the fruit trees and watch the fungicides, mm-hmm. do your pruning. Now, this is the first quarter of the moon, and it's in Libra. Now, Libra's a very fertile sign, but when there's a first quarter of the moon, it's a no-no planting day, because here we've got the sun and the moon clashing together. So it's no good for plants, because they feel very sick when you plant them on a first quarter or the full moon or the last quarter. So get your garden ready today. And then on the 10th, the 11th and the 12th, the moon is actually moving into Scorpio on the 10th and stays there until the 12th. That is a fabulous time, absolutely fabulous time, for all above-ground crops. Now, if you're doing your veggies, of course, this is an excellent time to put in your broad beans and your peas and your rhubarb, you know, your strawberries and asparagus, anything that grows above the ground. So from the 10th to the 12th, all your plants that grow above the ground, including your shrubs and flowers, perennials and things like that as well. Mm-hmm. Then the moon enters Sagittarius on Saturday the 13th, and it's there till the end of Sunday the 14th. So those 2 days, you can have a little bit of a rest. But that's 2 days if you want to. You can do a little bit of light pruning on those days, just a little bit of light pruning. But what I would advise, the moon is going into Capricorn, which is also a semi-fertile sign, on the 15th. That's Monday. So over this weekend, if you've got any transplanting to do, I would suggest you pull those old trees out or shrubs and do some transplanting on Saturday and Sunday. And don't forget to give them a nice big hole before you put them in, mm-hmm. and make sure you put a little bit of sea salt or something like that in, a bit of fertilizer once they're in, and give them a good water. Because when the moon goes into Capricorn on the 15th, the 15th and 16th, again, is where above-ground crops you should plant, like your cabbage and your cauliflowers, etc., and your perennials. But those are all above-ground days. And those transplanted shrubs and trees, and out of the seed boxes as well, will come into a nice connection here with the moon. Now, the moon on the Wednesday, the 17th, is a full moon. Now, this is going to be actually an eclipse month this month. So we've got a lunar eclipse there. And, of course, this puts a very serious aspect over the garden. And you've got to be very careful on eclipses, because weather can change very quickly, you know, from cold to hot to cold and all sorts of things, rain to snow. So definitely no planting, no gardening at all on the full moon on the 17th of July. Okay. Now, then it goes into Aquarius on the 18th and 19th. Now, those are two negative signs there in Aquarius. So the 18th and 19th, just prepare when the moon goes into Pisces, which is a very fertile sign, on the 20th and the 21st. and even into the 22nd, because the moon doesn't go into Aries until 8 o'clock on the 22nd. So Saturday, Sunday of the 20th and the 22nd, you can now put in your below ground plants. So you can put your seed potatoes in, and you can put your beets, anything that grows under the ground, your turnips, anything that onions that grow under the ground. So those are your best days for this 2 weeks. Is certainly going to be the 20th and the 21st over that weekend. And on the 22nd, you can plant right up till 8 o'clock at night. So the moon doesn't go until to Aries until that time.
But Milton, it's still dark on July at that.
All you got to do is get your torch and go out there with your torch, Jen.
Great.
It's really good.
Stick one on my head.
Yeah, but it does get dark very quickly. But, you know, I always look at it this way too. You know, the best way to garden really is to put on a wide-brimmed straw hat and some old clothes, have a hoe in one hand, a cold beer in the other hand, and get somebody else, such as your wife or someone, to do the digging.
Oh.
That's how I think it's a good one. But actually, it is a good couple of weeks for the garden. And just remember, we've got the pests of the month. This month coming up is going to be that little mealy bug. That little mealy bug is a real nuisance. But this is the best days to spray, really, is going to be later in this month.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks very much, Milton. We'll talk soon.
You're welcome.
Well, that was a great episode, don't you think, Jenny?
Yes, I do. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more Garden Chat. But in the meantime, Adam, where can people find you?
Oh, the best way is to just search me up on YouTube. Put Adam Woodhams into YouTube and I'll pop up. Not the guy that does the fast fours and rotaries. I'm the guy that does gardening and landscape and all sorts of DIY stuff.
Fantastic. And if they want more garden inspiration before the next episode, follow us on Instagram at BHGAUS. If you enjoyed this episode of Garden Better, please take a moment to rate and review the show. It's the best way to help other garden lovers find us.
Thanks, Jenny. See you next time.
Sure. See you then.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.